January 23rd, 2021, is a Watch for Pedro show.
Thank you.
Watt for Pedro show. Happy Saturday. Happy. Well, let's tell people what we heard. That's John Coltrane with After the Rain, and maybe it's kind of still during the rain. It's a little rainy here in Pedro still. Then we had All Souls with Reveille. And, Brother Matt at the Love Grotto on the Pleasure Point here a couple miles south because quit quarantine mode still. But I am not totally man alone, people, because those software engineers in Estonia with their righteous Skype invention, I got Meg Castellanos. Welcome aboard, Meg.
Thank you. It's an honor.
And Meg, where are you talking to me from?
I'm talking to you from Boyle Heights.
Boyle Heights.
Just east of the L.A. River, Los Angeles.
And people, Boyle Heights, East L.A., also known in a way, and a lot of history, a lot of different kinds of peoples. There used to be a few versions of the Vex Club.
Yep.
And so Minutemen got, some noise over there. Minutemen got to play. In,
was that on Cesar Chavez or Brooklyn Avenue?
I think it was called Sunset then, but yeah, they renamed that part Cesar Chavez. Yeah. What was his name? Joe, right? Joe Vex. That's how we knew him. And he had it in a couple places. And in fact, one turned into a cultural center that I later played with Dose with Ian's band with his wife, Amy. Evans. I did a gig with Dose and Evans at a repurposed version of the Vex into a cultural center. Yeah, I was so bitching to see because, a lot of pads, when they go through their phase, they're gone forever. But this,
right.
This did. This had some noise over there. Cállate. But anyway, it was bitching to see that again, that the chain hadn't been broken. It just took a different form, and there was young people there learning stuff, and the DIY ethic, right? It kept going.
Yeah. Well, the last show that All Souls played was at this place called the Paramount Ballroom.
Oh, yeah.
Which is upstairs, and that was the Vex for a little while.
Yeah,
all
I remember.
The old posters are on the wall still.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, loading your gear was kind of shitty, but I still I still like playing it. I haven't seen Joe Vex in many years, but, man, we played all four of them, I think.
Oh, cool.
In different places. Some were right by downtown, right under the freeway, but then some were more East L.A. But let's get to your musical journey, Meg. What's your earliest musical recollection, memory?
It's interesting because I consider myself more of a performer than a musician because that's my background. So, music definitely influenced what I was doing, but I started off as a figure skater. So I did that my whole childhood. And my dad owned a nightclub, so that was a big influence on me too. So he had this place in the middle of the disco era in the 70s called RC's Lounge, which was his initials. And they had live music. Mostly regional bands would come through. And it also was a disco, so I was, I was a child of the 70s, so super into Donna Summer and then early rap like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and all that stuff. Roller skating was a big thing back then. But my dad had this band called the Tavares play. It was the biggest thing ever to happen for his club. They were on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack with More Than a Woman was their biggest hit. So I got to hang out at his club a lot and see how live music worked, at a very early age, and just absorb all that. And there was this one all-girl group that I thought were badass that would play. And so that was my earliest influences, was just sort of sitting at my dad's disco watching these bands play.
What about at home? Was there any instruments?
Nope. Okay. Nope, I was skating. I was skating on ice. My dad did give me an acoustic guitar, and just like any first song you ever learned, Smoke on the Water, like I had an ear for it. So I could pick things out and, I wasn't really interested in playing until I got to college. So, yeah, my background was more like skating and dance and
Can I ask you about grade school? Were you in the choir or marching band or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Well, every kid had to take recorder at my school.
Yeah.
So
I should tell people, recorder ain't a tape recorder. It's a kind of a diatonic flute.
That's right.
Usually plastic.
Yeah. And I think we played Nadia's theme, which was Nadia Comaneci.
Sure.
Which was a big hit on the radio back then.
Romanian gymnast.
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay. Well, I always ask that because, Meg, some schools get rid of their fucking music and arts program. Yes.
You know, and you're reminding me, too, music was a big thing in my school. And I grew up in Massachusetts on Cape Cod. It's like pretty nautical area. And, you know, lots of whaling happened off Nantucket, you know, way back when. But there's, you know, it's kind of a fishing village. And we learned sea shanties in school, so that was kind of a big thing for us back then.
You know, the shanties were important because to coordinate the, you know, you had to pull them, them sails were heavy. And to pull, coordinate the tugging on the rope, they used the, they were kind of work songs.
Yes, they were work songs. So that had an influence for sure.
Were you there? Because you were talking East L.A., and now... Yeah, I'm here in Cape Cod. So Cape Cod was before East L.A.
Yeah, so I grew up in Massachusetts. I grew up in a little town called Falmouth on Cape Cod and went to college in Boston. So I left home when I was 17, went to school right near Kenmore Square, art school called Emerson College. And, you know, we were right next to the Ratskeller, and so that's when the whole punk rock and goth and that influence entered into my life. I mean, I was already listening to a lot of bands, you know, from the 80s, like I loved The Clash and Devo and B-52s and The Cure and stuff like that, Husker Du too. But it wasn't until I got to Boston where I was starting to go to see shows. And it was pretty live. It was pretty wild. You know, like all ages shows were happening. So we got to go to see a lot of stuff that was happening in Boston.
There was a club there called The Channel. And Minuteman got to play with Husker Du there, and they were only Sundays because it was and they're kind of a matinee thing.
Yep. And I saw Iggy Pop there at the Channel probably back in about 87 or so.
It ended up burning down, and then Minutemen played a lot at the Rat too. You said Ratskeller, that was
Oh my god! So, I wish I saw you there.
So Meg, you end up on bass. How'd that happen?
I blame Kim Deal for that. Yeah, I saw the Pixies play really early on at the Paradise in Boston, and that was probably like 89 or so. And I stood right in front of her and just was like, I don't know, man, she had something. And it just felt like something I could do. So it was that night. I was like, I'm moving to California and I'm going to start a band. I didn't even know how to play. I just knew that I was going to make that happen somehow. And I did. But it was sort of a winding road in order to get to where I actually started playing. But, you know, I lived in houses and apartments all with, you know, dudes who had instruments lying around. There's always a bass lying around. So that was the thing that I gravitated to. I would just, you know, pick one up and learn how to play a Fugazi riff or something like that. And I knew I had an ear for it, but I just didn't really know how to get started. You know, I just felt like music was way more complicated and I needed to study. But when I got to San Francisco in 1990, I had this big warehouse space and we started putting on shows. I would produce them and book the bands and have dance performances and art gallery openings and stuff. And I just started getting more immersed in the rock scene and just going to rehearsal spaces with my friends and starting to play. And that's how it started.
What was the first bass you got?
That was my roommate Eli gave me, it was like a Hofner knockoff, a Japanese knockoff of a Hofner.
Like a Beatle bass?
Yes, the Beatle bass.
And your first amp?
I think it was a Galleon Kruger.
Okay, because you know, I'm a little biased towards bass, you know, so I want to know. I'm always curious.
Yeah, that bass got stolen, though, and I ended up getting this really weird-looking, it was a custom Solona, and it was a three-quarter scale. It fit me really well because I'm kind of small. And everybody, anywhere I went to play that thing, people just came up to the stage and were like, what the hell is that? It was all one long piece of wood, blonde, really beautiful, like a nice shape to it. So I played that for many, many years. And then I switched over to Mesa Boogie amps. And then finally, I play a Rickenbacker now.
Petaluma Mesa Boogies.
Chicken
Capital of California. What was the first gig that you played in front of people working the bass?
Say that again?
The first gig you did working the bass in front of people.
Oh, first gig. I would have to say that was... Okay, so before Toady Moshi, I was in this band called Valley Fever. And it was sort of like a circus rock band with Tony and a couple of other guys. And that was a warehouse party in San Francisco.
And was it a success?
Yeah, it was. Because there were people in the audience that I really respected that were sort of checking us out with their arms folded and, you know, like...
stroking on the chin, right? Stroking the chin. Meg, I want to play Maricela, right?
Maricela.
Blood, long hair and feet, dark moon, watch the way that it's time we came on the show. The show about changing, but we had that show. I'm holding by my heartbeat. Part of me, they must be. To copy me, myself, and I will be so sad. The greatest voice to the lies, and the bad guys, I believe. Get in my stride. Just in case, falling in a tall grass. Drinking till the time. Full, no recognize. Suddenly I can't get my reflection. My passion. When you came back in my blessing. Left foot, right foot. Keep striking on the street you sell. Can you make it many more sales? No more than to sell the tale.
felt like I was really getting towards Alzheimer's. I was hoping it wasn't Alzheimer's. But I was finding myself repeating myself very often, just in a normal conversation. And I felt that I better do something to help with my memory. My daughter is the one that came up with this program here. One of my sons drove me over for the first time to find out what it was about, because he wanted to see it too, what all was involved in it. This was actually not too long ago, and I thought it was quite interesting, and decided to register and keep on coming back on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And you know what? It has helped me. Since I've been coming here, I have not noticed any further deterioration of my memory. Nothing I can detect, anyway. I'm satisfied.
Thank you. beyond.
Almost in rap.
she looked at him and poof, you know, was gone. You know, just gone.
For Pedro Show, yeah, Marcella from Alma Sangre, left foot, right foot, from Model Home, brand new record from Model Home, a great band out of D.C., Napping Pat, and Mika Levy, she's got a new thing, Change Baggy, Satisfied by David Greenberger and Paul Sabar, Tomorrow Sound, Off the Spring from Hans Rotten in Switzerland, Foodie from Osaka with Nano, Dustin Wong, he's in K-Town these days, huh? Beyonder, Bulma's printing from the D.C. area, not at home. Gaz Like, not me. I added that, fuck. From Dosa Drone out of Belfast. And then finally, Alma Sagre again, La Loma. You know, the town next to Pedro, well, one of them. La Mita, right? Little Hill. So, what is this Alma Sangre?
Alma Sangre was a project that my husband Tony and I started. We really wanted to do something different after Tony Moshi wound down, And we'd always talked about using my dance background. I've been studying flamenco dancing for a long time. And I wanted to do the rhythm. I mean, not just play the bass, but when you wear flamenco shoes, they have little nails tapped into the bottom of them. So similar to tap, but much stronger. And
that's because it's really percussive. It's almost like the rhythm
section. It's a percussion.
Yeah, it's part of the rhythm section.
It's a percussion of flamenco. So I also got a cajon, which is one of those drums that you sit on. It's like a box.
The box.
Yeah, and it's got snare strings, you know, so it's got a little bit of a rattle, nice rattle to it. And so I was kind of Tony was obviously the front person because he sang in Spanish, played the flamenco guitar. And but I was kind of front and center in that band because I would get up off my cajon and dance and do the rhythms. And it was very kind of...
Can I ask you a trippy question?
Sure.
When you danced doing flamenco, did you smile?
No.
Yeah, because, you know, I seen in the old Jewish part of Sevilla, I was there with Stooges. We had days off. Uh-huh. And this lady, kind of Moorish-looking lady... And no smiling. It was like,
no, there's not a lot of smiling. In
yeah, it was really intense.
There's one dance called Alegria, which is more upbeat and happy.
Right.
And we smile during that one, or we smile when we dance Sevillanas, which is the folk partner dance that is often done out in these streets. But no, when you're performing flamenco, you sort of embody sorrow.
Yeah, and right. It's kind of like a blues, right?
Exactly.
The singer man was from Cordoba, and you could just tell, you know, with his palms to the sky and just, you know, singing his heart out, this kind of sadness.
Yep.
D-Boom was a huge fan of flamenco. In fact, this guy,
wow.
Roy Mendez Lopez, who taught him it, you know, this guy lived in his car and shit, right? Really Cano, but he was like, practice, and D-Boone just fell in love with flamenco. And when I got to see some of that, not the kitsch stuff, but this real, no amplifiers, you know, it was
acoustic.
It was incredible. Look, if I'm out of order, let's start with Tony Mushy.
So that was a band that we had. We started that in 1997, and speaking of Icano, I actually just rewatched it this morning, we jam Icano. We kind of based our band, kind of off of your guys' ethic. I mean, we just went out and started touring, we'd do these like 6 weeks across the country in a van, sleeping in rest stops, sleeping on people's floors. I mean, we hit it hard. We would do like full U.S. tours at least 2 or 3 times a year. And, we made nothing. We just, anything we made went in the gas tank. But that's how we built it up. You know, we did that for many years, and we were on various labels, and we had a lot of friends that got, you know, a good level of success that would invite us on tours with them. So we did a lot. We were able to get to Europe and Canada and did a ton of touring across the states, and ended up doing some pretty big shows and working with some pretty great producers. And that's how we met Toshi.
Yeah. Where did the name come from?
That came from Tony. He heard his mom say something about something that sounded like Tony Mushy, but it wasn't. So it's kind of a made up name.
Okay.
And you know, when you choose a name that nobody can pronounce, it's kind of a detriment to your band and being able to promote yourself. Often got labeled like from Japan.
What was the first Tony Mushy gig?
That one was in North Beach in San Francisco at this place called the Cocodrie, which used to be called Morty's before that. And, that was the first gig. It was probably like a 5-band bill, and I stood like a statue. I was just glued to staring at my bass because I couldn't take my eyes off of it yet.
So it was different than the Valley gig?
Yeah. So that one, you know, we were angry. We were way more metal. We started that band in Oakland, and I think we were pretty influenced by a lot of the metal that was going on in Oakland at that time. So Tony did a lot of screening back in those days, and it was just heavier, louder, and, you know, really fun to play because you get your aggressions out.
Yeah, absolutely. Like kind of a, you're saying like kind of a therapy?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Why not? Or a pressure relief valve.
Right? Exactly. That's what it felt like.
And so, yeah, you got into the torn. Yeah, when you ain't playing, you're paying, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so
yeah, and we kind of set up our lives to be able to just hit the road, too, you know? So we would sock some money away. I'm also a massage therapist, so, you know, I work for myself, basically. So I would just work and work and work, you know, put some money aside and then hit the road. And, you know, we had a slew of drummers. I lost count. We were in the double digits. But people didn't last very long with us. I mean, we had some that lasted longer than others. But I think when you're in a band with a couple and a three-piece especially, you might feel like you're the odd man out, unfortunately. And as inclusive as we tried to be, you know, people have issues. They have families. They have drug problems. They move on, you know, so we tried to keep that together, but it was a challenge.
The third part, because a drummer, yep. Rock and roll, the drummer is very important, right?
It is important, and, you know, amazingly enough, we were able to get some really great players there. I mean, some not so good, obviously, but it's not only
the playing, right? You got to have a personality that can deal with that kind of torn and stuff like that.
Well, that's just as important as far as we're concerned, because...
No, I believe you. I believe you, Meg.
You know, and back in those days, we're sharing a room. We have dogs on. We brought our big dogs. We had a pit bull and a golden retriever. We brought those dogs with us everywhere we went. So, I mean, sometimes it's not just our band in the room. It's our band, the other band, the merch person, and two dogs in a two queen hotel room.
Sure, sure.
So you better like the people that you're traveling with.
Yeah, we're at the end of the first hour, January 23rd, 2021, edition Watt Peter Show. Special guest, Meg Castellanos. Hold tight for hour two. January 23rd, 2021. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Reclaman culpa. isso pra lá. Vem pra cá, que é? E não tô fazendo nada, você também. Faz nada ter um papo chico, eu sou como alguém. Ei, deixe, me diga o que pensa, que fala. Deixa isso pra lá, vem pra cá, que é? E não tô fazendo nada, você também. Faz nada ter um papo chico, eu sou como alguém. Ei. Deixa que diga, que pensa, que fala. Deixa isso pra lá, vem pra cá, que é? E não tô fazendo nada, você também. Faz nada ter um papo chico, gostoso como alguém. Ei, deixa que diga, que pensa, que fala. Deixa isso pra lá, vem pra cá, que é? E não tô fazendo nada, você também. Faz nada ter um papo chico, gostoso como alguém. Ei.
Western model. His name was dark and his hair was grey. He asked me what I was looking for. I said I came to see the buffalo. And then he opened his garage at the back, showed me his wish and the life he led. And so we started our Christmas break. The snow was falling and we talked at the back.
Only dogs and fans, I can see me inside. And they know I'm not crazy.
He played me his violin and talked of science and of medicine. He's got a bad experience. He's got a bad experience. Scared the shit out of me. Next morning I woke wide awake. Started the car and hit the dance. I took from my cheese pie to Spain and my thought genius in the circuit trance.
Only dogs and fans, I can see me inside. And they know I'm not crazy.
Watt for Pedro. Shall we start off the second hour with El Cortito?
El Cortito.
Yeah, Cortito. Watt, get it together. I remember, you know, I came from Virginia when I was like nine. And in baby housing over there, I knew some Filipino and Puerto Rico, but Mexican, it was new for me. And mm-hmm. It was really interesting. Yeah, I fell in love with the chow and the culture, everything. And, but I still fuck up the pronunciation, so I'm so sorry. Okay, Sam Ben after that, and he's been living in Tokyo 25 years, so he could have joined Toto Monkey. and something Brazilian, right? Desa Iso Pra La. And he had to, like, phonetically get this. Sam Lockward from Iowa City after that. We are the workers. We the workers. Fucked up. Maggie Bjorndund with Walking. Morty out of Poland with Western Motel. Talking about that motel room. 06 from Talman Dietrich. John Dietrich from Deerhoof. Great guitar, man. Hi, Maya. Amplified for Clarity. Charity. Old days from Cleveland. And finally, Todemoshi, The Seeing Eye. So I got all the fucking songs out of order. Sorry about that. So how long did Todemoshi last?
We went from 97 to about 2012.
Wow. Okay. That's 15
years. Yeah, about 15 years.
And what pulled the plug? Well, you guys probably.
No. Okay, so we decided to move to Los Angeles. And our drummer came with us, which was great. I mean, he actually moved out from Kansas City to try out for Todemoshi, and he joined the band, moved out to San Francisco Bay Area, and we did that for a while. And then we decided to pick up and move to L.A. And, you know, it was hard. All of us had to move, and we had to start over. And starting over when you're 40, it's a little bit of a challenge. But Tony got a job opportunity, but that actually fell through, and we had already planned to move. So we're like, you know what? Fuck it. We're gonna do it. We loved Los Angeles, and we loved the music scene down here, and we had a lot of friends down here. So Buzz from the Melvins, we had done some touring with them, and he offered Tony a job doing guitar teching with them. So as soon as we got down to L.A., Tony left to tour with the Melvins, and he started doing tour managing stuff. So he was traveling quite a bit with the Melvins and Sleep and Neurosis and bands like that. And we continued Todemoshi. I think we did another album down here. And then our drummer just couldn't figure out how to make a living. He didn't have a car. I think that was the biggest problem.
Yeah, oh, car, in SoCal. Right? In SoCal,
yeah.
You need
a car. Yeah, you have to have a car. So he was taking the train down to, like, a Borders Books in Long Beach. And, I mean, he was just miserable. So he ended up moving back to Kansas City. So that's when we decided, you know what, it just feels like we're kicking a dead horse at this point. I mean, the last tour that we did was kind of a disaster. It just, our booking agent had, you know, he said, everything's cool, you know, you got all these dates. And then when it came time to leave, it wasn't cool. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of the dates weren't booked, and the turnout was not that great. And so, you know, at that point in your career, we had done some really high profile tours, and, you know, when you come back home and you do a shitty tour, it's kind of a blow. So, you know, we didn't decide to pack it in per se, but we just sort of put it on hold. And Chris moved back to Kansas City. That's when we started Alma Sangre, and we just shifted our attention and started doing this acoustic thing, which was completely different because we got to play these art galleries. We played in, like, Spanish restaurants. We played a couple of clubs, but that wasn't the focus. We wanted, you know, it was quiet. We could play anywhere, and I really liked that change. And I liked being able to get back into my dancing.
Yeah. So
Yeah, when things go screwy, you improvise and you use your strengths. So all that stuff you invested in.
Yep.
Yeah. I want to play, in honor of Tony Moshi, let's play one more song. The Dance of the Snakes.
Oh, cool.
And so the dance begins, the gods are beckoning, formulating messages in tone. The shape of quivering, the snake of slithering, quantum is the answer as we sneak across the brain cells that roam. Your son and lamb, you see his grave.
And here you've got your gun, and now you see his dad.
Thank you. use this, of course, if I have.
I'm astonished and struck reading your books by how early your love of gardening began. Is that right?
I should have been a gardener. I don't know why I wasn't. I suppose that no one in my world, my parents' world, thought of gardening as an occupation, really, that a school one might take up. And I'd forgotten about it, but I had kept all my gardening implements. I gardened.
How were you given? When did you first garden? Who said garden? Did you say I want to garden?
I think I said it first in Villa Quassa, Largo Maggiore, when I was four. And I was absolutely entranced by this place, the sunlight after an English RAF station, avenues of camellias. It was a house which was requisitioned on the lake. And I think it's there. I've got some film, and I'm picking geraniums.
Did you want to be an artist?
Yes, I wanted to be a painter. I never wanted to be a filmmaker. That happened by accident, but I'd always wanted to be a painter.
What sort of painter were you? What sort of stuff did you do?
Well, I potted through all the isms, you know, all the isms you can imagine, cubism and dashism, and I finally caught up with sort of just straightforward English landscape painting, and I found myself down at the Kilns in North Somerset, where my aunt lived, just painting the fields. And in a way, these rather old-fashioned paintings are the first ones I recognise as my own. Then, of course, I went to the Slade and the modern movement. It was, you know, America. We all had to grapple with that.
Did you grapple happily?
Not particularly, no. I found myself quite nervous. I realised I wasn't a very good draftsman, although actually the Slade gave me a distinction of a draftsman. I think they must have not been looking.
When did you first design for the theatre or for film?
I started actually out of the Slade because you had to do a subsidiary. And Nicholas Georgiard was teaching there, and I thought, well, with my university upbringing, you know, where I had been involved in college theatre and everything, it would be a good thing to do. So I went in there and did theatre design as a subsidiary, but with no idea that I would actually ever... I mean, when I was at the Slade, I thought I would end up teaching in school somewhere. I mean, that was the length of one's ambition.
You designed for the Royal Ballet, you designed Jazz Calendar, and you designed for Ken Russell's movies. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because of I put some theatre designs for the Prodigal Son of Prokofiev into the Biennale in Paris. And Maud Lloyd's Hub.
Thank you.
Oh my God, they were so good. They were very proggy. I think they toured with Jethro Tull.
Yeah, people were talking about this 70s band called Carmen, and they kind of tried to bridge flamenco and rock and roll, but Meg's flamenco teacher was one of these guys.
Yeah, I actually really like Carmen. People should check that out.
And they had some dancing, you know, for the percussion. In fact, it was like it was part of the sound, right? They had like pickups on this little stage at the
How you usually mic the stage when you mic flamenco.
So the
dancers can be heard.
Sure, absolutely. And another big thing that people don't realize, because a lot of this, it's not just the Moorish and Spanish, but there's also a gypsy thing. And they got their families, and they do the hand clapping.
That's called palmas.
Palmas, so right, absolutely.
Palmas, yeah.
And there's
there's different ways to do it, but that's a big part of the percussion of flamenco. And that's also helping the dancers stay in time. You know, people in the background will be clapping.
Right, right.
And, that's cool stuff. I'm so stoked that you know of that.
Yeah, I told you. D. Boone was way into that. There's a song on Double Nickels. He took from La Linda, which is an old flamenco song. The Doors did too, right? Turned into Spanish Caravan.
Oh, that's right, right.
I should tell the people what we just heard. The Dance Snakes, Totemushi. And then Here and Then, Trupa Trupa from Poland. Don the Tiger. La Decima Quinta Fibre de Arturo Vélez. And sorry, again, people. Arubu Avua with Sercal. That's Portuguese. I fucked that up too. But I'm an equal opportunity fucker upper of language. Not on purpose, though, because I have big respect. Gareth Sager, up that miniature 20. Gareth from the pop group. Alessandra Novara from Italy with I Should Have Been a Gardener. And finally, Silence from All Souls. So when was the first All Souls gig?
First All Souls gig. I'm blanking out, but we started in 2017. Oh, I think we went up to San Francisco. We played the Independent, which used to be called the Kennel Club.
Oh, before that it was the VIS Club, and it was only one. They didn't knock out the overhead. I played there on Divisadero, right?
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
By the Church of St. John Coltrane. Mm-hmm. And brother-in-law's number two, Great Ribs, at one time.
That's right.
No, there's a parallel thing going. You still got Ama Sangre going. Why are you doing All Souls? So All Souls, you want it to be like a rock and roll way of doing gigs, right?
Yeah, we missed rocking out. So Tony actually did another band. They never released an album, but that kind of fell apart. That was with, I don't know if you remember a band called 400 Blows, Ferdy the drummer.
Christian Wapshaw, Pedro.
Yes,
and
that's
Ferdy
right.
Ferdy on the drums, a Filipino guy, a great
drummer.
You know,
okay, so funny enough, me and Tony, Christian, and Ferdy, we were jamming for a while after Totemushi wound down, and we were going to start a band. But Christian has a family, and he pretty much stopped playing music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he left Pedro.
Yeah. So Ferdy and Tony started a band with another guy called Last Days of Ancient Sunlight. And they were doing that for a while. They put out a pretty cool video, and they had some good songs. They played around. But that kind of fell apart. And then we started All Souls. And so we knew Tony Tornay forever, because Fatso Jetson and Totemushi used to play together.
Mario.
Yeah, and worship, you know, that band, and loved. I mean, we would always be like, oh, man, if we could only get a drummer like Tony Tornay. Then we got him.
You know what? Ferdy's good, too, though, man. I really like Ferdy. Look, we're at the end of the second hour, January 23rd, 2021, Dish Wap Pilo Show. Special guest, Meg Castellanos. Hold tight for hour three. January 23rd, 2021. It's the third hour of the Wap Pedro Show. Watt for Pedro show. We start the third hour off with All Souls. Do We Never Know, Exploded View. Something Dirk Vandenberg put together. I could only play a little excerpt because the recording was so bad. McCrane and Mark Tamarovich was part of it. They only did one gig. Gold Mines after that, Double Snap. Ella Dreams of Circuses from David Gerard, Steve Dews, and Todomoshi. Flashback. Make Your Day. Now, I didn't get you to finish your first gig. You guys drive up to the city, right? You do the first All Souls gig?
Yeah, that might have been the second one. Now that I'm remembering, the first one was in the Arts District at one of the clubs over there. So that was the very first one. But, yeah, I think our second one was up at the old channel, the Independent. And we were traveling with a couple of other bands, our friends in this band called Torch. And they invited us to open a couple of gigs with them in California. So we kind of hit the road right away.
I saw Torch open for Boris. They were kind of a heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Sludgy, but kind of poppy, too.
Yeah, so also, but with All Souls, you were going to definitely try something different than Todomoshi?
Yeah, so because we were focused more on the vocals and actually singing in Alma Sangre, because Tony was singing and his voice was really up front. You know, there's nothing to hide behind when you're playing acoustic. So he was super into this singer called Chavela Vargas, which was a ranchera singer.
Yeah.
And his voice changed, and the vocals became way more important, and we wanted to do something that was more catchy, and we wanted to bring in another guitar player and have the two guitars feed off one another, harmony, stuff like that. So All Souls was very premeditated, and we chose to work with musicians that we had traveled with, we knew we got along with, but that we really respected their playing. So that's how All Souls formed. You know, we kind of had an idea that we wanted to be darker, you know, like influences from The Birthday Party and Nick Cave, but we also love The Cure, The Pixies. You know, we wanted it to be like memorable, like you hear us and it kind of bores into your head. So that song that you played, Never Know, like that's super catchy. And, you know, it's long though. It's like a 7-minute song. So we're still jamming out, and it's very guitar forward, but our songs are a little bit more poppy than Todomoshi ever was.
Did any songs carry over? Does All Souls do any Todomoshi?
Nope.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because I have another Todomoshi song. But I'm so fucked up. I should have found out about the order. But, you know, I remember talking with Tony. Now it's all coming back to me. I'm such an idiot.
No, well, you talk to a ton of people. I know. How you keep anything straight.
Yeah, but you deserve respect. Oh, I mean, Jesus. But anyway, this is Forever in Bone, Los Dos.
The story defies understanding. A coming to life underground. Crawling to find. Frozen with time, the mother who's since passed away. A life you could only imagine. A son you will never see. Follow your mind, follow your kind. Swallow what's given away. Never to wonder. Never to roam. Never to sit right beside her. You are forever. In bone, a life you could only imagine, a sun you will never see. Follow your mind, follow your kind, swallow what's given away. Never to wander, never to roam, never to walk right beside the tomb.
Thank you.
Pedro Show, last music for this edition. Forever in Bone, Los Dos, Todemochi. Out of order. They don't do Todemochi anymore, people. It's All Souls. And I'm a singer. Mike Cooper after that, Las Balsas. Tim Wholehouse with Artistic. And finally, Death Becomes Us. All Souls. Talk about dark. So, what's the process? How does All Souls write a song? Does Tony bring it to you?
Yeah, so a lot of the kernel of the music comes from Tony. He'll come up with riffs, or actually Tony Tournay will bring in some riffs too. And we'll sit in the studio and flesh it out. And I'm going to call Antonio, my husband Tony. I mean, call him Antonio so we can keep it separate. Okay. So Antonio will write a lot of the music, but then he'll just have phonetics as vocals. And then sometimes if I feel like I want to take on the lyrics to a song, I'll write the lyrics or he'll write the lyrics. But, you know, we share a lot of the writing responsibilities, but I would say a lot of the songwriting comes from Antonio, from Tony Aguilar.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, is there an outlet for, like, Meg Castellanos' songwriting?
Yeah, so, I mean, I feel like I contribute in the studio as far as bass lines, and there are certain things that I brought in, like Make Your Day, for instance, in Todemochi. Like, I had a good part of writing that. You know, there's stuff from, you know, Death Becomes Us. I wrote the lyrics for that. I wrote the lyrics for Reveille. So, you know, I consider myself a little bit of a writer. And that's, I would say I contribute that way, but also a lot with the aesthetic, like, you know, with how we look on stage and our album covers and video. So I play a big part in the aesthetics of, you know, how we're putting ourselves out there.
But, you know, All Souls, it's full of you. You don't need, like, a solo band, a solo proj.
No. Okay. It serves as an outlet for a lot of different sides of my creativity.
Yeah. That's to have a situation like that is so bitching. So you don't have to, be all like cut into pieces.
And especially during the lockdown, the pandemic, it's like we put out an album in the middle of all this. We put out two videos. And we're writing our next album, so it's great to have an outlet right now because there's no shows.
Yeah. So it's got to be all like kind of what the C word content.
Because
the P word perform right now is a little postponed, but it's going to come back. We just got to get some more vaccines in the arms.
I got the first one.
You did? Great.
Yep.
Fuck. Yeah, Biba. happening. Well, I remember Tony talking about the record, and in fact, the situation kind of bears on the material, right?
Yes. So it's called, the second record of All Souls is called Songs for the End of the World. And, you know, we wrote that before I came up with the title, and we named it well before the pandemic. You know, because as you know, when you write music and get an album together, it takes sometimes a year before it can be released out into the world. So we were really focused on, like, what was happening with that idiot in office for the last 4 years and the climate, you know. So there was a lot of heavy themes going on that we were having to contend with before the pandemic even showed up. So we were writing about that, really, and addressing the political situation. Titling it Songs for the End of the World when the pandemic hit, it was like, holy shit. it fit the time so well.
A little prophetic.
Yeah, and especially the song Death Becomes Us. I mean, it's like a funeral dirge. And, you know, I lost both my parents, like, within 6 months of each other during that, but, like, after I wrote that. So it was kind of prophetic, yeah. Actually.
That's the trippy thing about music. It connects a lot of things. It can.
Yeah, it yeah. Can. It's true.
What about a young woman wanting to get in her rock and roll, a little bit younger than you, or just starting or something? What advice, Meg, would you give?
I would just say, you know, be yourself, because people are attracted to originality. And if you are just completely doing what comes from within, you're going to inspire somebody or a lot of people. But, you know, if you end up copying other people, it's not as important. I mean, some people get away with it, and that's how they get popular too, because they're just doing something that connects or that people are familiar with. But, I mean, like, looking at bands like what you did with the Minutemen, I mean, nobody sounds like you guys. Nobody since has come along that has done anything like what you guys did. And I think that's what sets bands like you apart. You know, it's like, it's just so from the heart. And you guys started out not even really knowing how to play your instruments to becoming, like, super accomplished. But you just dug in, you know. And I think that's kind of what you need to do.
That's good advice. But I got to tell you, we did have a lot of influence. But we thought the best respect would not be really copying.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you set out to do something great, so you have to look at the greats in order to be able to even try to emulate that. That's for sure.
Oh, you're very, very wise, man. It's been such an honor to have you on the show. Thanks.
Oh, pleasure.
I know you guys are probably working on another record, right?
Yeah, we are. So we have a new guitar player. Eric decided to bow out at the middle of last year. So we've got this new guy named Matt Price, and he's a burner. He's a ripper. So we're really looking forward to, you know, recording with him. We got to get back in the studio with Toshi as soon as possible. He just had a baby yesterday, by the way.
Oh, bitchin'. Well, my dad, Toshi. That means congratulations. Anyway, when you get it done, please let me hear it, Lynn. Come back on the show and let's talk about it.
Hell yeah.
Okay, Meg. People, it's been January 23rd, 2021, and Dishwap Pedro. So keep your powder dry.